Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
And welcome to another episode of the Council of Trent podcast. It's Friday, and that means it's Free for All Friday here on the podcast, where we get to talk about all kinds of different topics that I find to be interesting. Before I get to that, though, a big shout out to our supporters at TrenthornPodcast.com. You make the podcast possible. Because we've been growing with our patron support, I'm able to do video content, short form videos on the Council of Trent YouTube page. Actually, if you search Council of Trent on YouTube, C-O-U-N-S-E-L Council, of course, the YouTube page should show up. It's a baby channel now. It's in its little infancy here, and it's growing, because before, when I would try to search for it, when it had like 8 subscribers, it would just say, did you mean the Council of Trent, like the 16th century ecumenical council? It's like Bishop Barron, and I think it still says that, but we're getting there where you can just see the channel right at the top, where I've got short form videos, we've got the longer rebuttal videos, probably next week or the week after. Probably by the end of next week, I'll be releasing the second part in my rebuttal series regarding Pastor Mike Winger and his videos that got a lot of views on YouTube that are critical of Catholicism. So I'll be releasing that. But know that you guys as patrons, you guys are making that possible. And if you want me to create more stuff like that, consider going to TrenthornPodcast.com to sign up. You also get access to bonus content this week. I'm going to be opening up the Q&A for all patrons soon to put out for a pro-life Q&A. We're going to do an open mailbag episode on pro-life around Roe v. Wade. You get the chance to ask me whatever you want if you're a subscriber. Also, we have a bonus release. If you enjoyed my interview with my pastor, Father James, about Eastern Catholicism, I've got a sneak peek from our 20 Answers booklet on Eastern Catholicism that you can read for free if you're a subscriber at TrenthornPodcast.com. All that and more for as little as $5 a month. Go and check it out. Now, what I wanted to... next week, by the way, just to give you a heads up of things we'll be moving into topic-wise. Probably next week, I'm going to do a debrief on my dialogue with Shannon Q on the issue of abortion and whether the unborn are persons. I thought that dialogue went very well, and I hope to have others like it in the future. Probably do a debrief on that next week, and then I got a lot of their great apologetics to share with you. So stay tuned for that. All right, the topic today is the secret world of movie theaters. I've probably said this in the podcast a few times, but in case you didn't know, my very first job was at a movie theater. I was 16 years old, and I'm grateful my mom did this. She's like, you're 16, you need to get a job. Not like I'm going to kick you out of the house if you don't get a job, but you need to learn responsibility. And I think jobs for teenagers are a great way to learn responsibility, learn you got to show up on time, you got to, you know, be behaved, you got to pay attention, you've got to do your job well. And when you're a squirrely teenager, you know, sometimes you have to learn those lessons the hard way. That's why, you know, it's funny when people talk about the minimum wage and people say, oh, the minimum, you know, now I'm getting into politics here. But one of the things people say, like, oh, well, the minimum wage should be, some people say it should be really high, like even more than $15 an hour, like $20 or $25 an hour. Or I've seen people online propose that. And if the minimum wage was that high, I remember when I was a kid and I went and got my first job at Harkins Movie Theaters, I think they paid me like $5.15 an hour to do that job. I mean, if it was like $25 an hour, I'm sure they would have just gotten some ticket taker robot or something to take my place to not have to do that. But if the minimum wage is that high, I would have never gotten a job experience to start at Harkins. And then to move on from there, after Harkins Movie Theaters, I went to work at Macy's, where I sold women's shoes. And that was my first commission-based job. In Macy's, there were two departments that worked on commission, cosmetics and women's shoes. And so sometimes when I was selling those women's shoes, I get those $500 Via Spiga boots out there. I was rolling, man. But then I also felt like the devil. I had women would come in. I remember this one woman. That's when it broke my heart and I decided to quit. She was buying these really expensive shoes. And she said, can you please tell me I look nice in these? And she seemed so sad. I was like, oh, I said, well, you look nice anyways, but why? She said, I need to impress these people at a party. So please just tell me I look nice in them. And I was like, people should be impressed with you, not on your shoes, but just by the person you are. And I remember I went in the back, you know, in the back of the shoe area is just this big storage thing. You know, it's kind of like a little warehouse with all the boxes and stuff like that. And I just put my head down. I was like, ah, can't do this anymore, and wrote out my 2 weeks notice. I think I handed it to my manager as a note. I didn't even tell her because I was a youngin' then when I did that. Now, one of my coworkers, actually, I did have some moments of levity there of doing women's shoes. The weirdest thing about selling women's shoes, you would think like, oh, isn't that more for women? It was all guys. It was all, I mean, go to a women's shoe department and see if this is the same. I feel like it's pretty similar. But when I worked at Macy's and sold women's shoes, like, there was only one woman. It was an elderly woman on our staff, but otherwise it was all men in the staff that were hired to sell women's shoes. All young, I would like to think attractive men, but all just young guys who were selling these women's shoes. And I don't know. I feel like maybe women, I don't know. You could, if you're a subscriber, you can comment on this on the episode at trendhornpodcast.com. I think women, part of the experience of going to shop for the shoes is to have a guy put the shoe on and off. And I don't know. There's just so much with it. I was like, time to get out of here, and got into television after that. That'll be another episode where I'll talk about that. I promise. Let's go back to the movie theater. So I worked at Harkins Movie Theaters, my first job. And I remember my friends from high school, they came by to look at me. I was 16 years old working there, because at Harkins, you had a spiffy uniform. I think AMC, you just have to wear like a red polo or something. No, Harkins, we went all out. I had a blue cummerbund. I had a blue bow tie. I had suspenders. In fact, there was a formal winter dance I went to once where I just wore my Harkins uniform to this formal winter dance it was one that was hosted by our church, actually. I'll have to find the picture. Maybe I can find a blast from the past picture and put it at trendhornpodcast.com. Then maybe people will sign up to see pictures of really goofy, distorted, elongated Trent, who was quite a few pounds lighter back then. So I worked there, and I started, actually, this is sad, I started working in concessions. So I was doing popcorn and sodas, and I was always trying to upsell people. You know, people would buy the soda, and I would say, oh, for 50 cents more, you can get twice as much. I think that was for the popcorn. For 50 cents more, you can have twice as much. People are like, oh, well, yeah. And so it was really, really rigorous when we were working there to do that. And they kept tabs on us, and you had to, you know, figure out your register by the end of the night and make sure that you weren't short or you weren't over. Some guys actually got fired because they were doing a souvenir cup refill scam. So what they would do, imagine, you know, when you go to the theater and get your souvenir cup, right? You buy for like 10 bucks and you get a dollar refill every time, usually. And so what these guys were doing was they would do the refill and you would get a dollar. They would pocket the dollar, because normally, like, by the end of the night, you have to do an inventory. Like, I would count how many popcorn bags are at my thing, how many soda cups are at my thing. And the money in the register had to match the popcorn bags and the cups that were there, because also there are people who are like giving away cups and bags to their friends who would come in. And that was a big no-no. But it's hard for the company to track the refill, a soda refill, because it just comes out of this carbonated tube and you wouldn't know. So these guys were taking dollars, and, you know, they might make like 20, 30, maybe 50 bucks in a night. And they thought the company was not the wiser, because you can't track the sodas like you can track the cups or the bags. Well, they can't track the inventory, but they noticed things were a bit off on their registers because they were low and couldn't figure out why. And so they started watching them on the cameras, and we had cameras over every register. So I'm like, Harkins didn't mess around, man. This is like Vegas. This is like Ocean's 11. The pit boss is back there keeping an eye on us. And they saw them pocket these dollar bills and put them in their pockets and then do the refills. So that was a serious black day there. So that was my first job. And I love working the movies, but it turns out I was bad at concessions. If you were good at usually you started in concessions. And if you were good at concessions, really good, you got moved up to box office and you would, you know, do the tickets at the box office. And that's like the big thing you could be promoted to. And if you were bad at concessions, you had to go to ticket taker or doing just trash and janitorial. And I was bad at concessions. So they moved me down to ticket taker. And so I just sit out in the front and I took the tickets. And so I remember doing it. I would have to stand there for like 2 or 3 hours at a time. And one trick I adopted was the tripod. Instead of keeping my feet together, because that kills you, I'd have my feet maybe like, I don't know, 18 inches apart. And because they wouldn't let me have a chair. They wouldn't let me have a chair to do it. Now I go to the movie theaters, I see people sitting in chairs behind like a thing. And I'm like, hey, you stand up. And where's your bow tie at? So I would do the tripod to keep my feet apart to do that. And so my job was just take the ticket and say it's on your left or it's on your right. And that is That is all that I did. I remember one lady came up, though. It was so funny. She had, and also I had to enforce the rule, no outside food or drink, which when I get to the part of the episode here, when I talk about concessions, you'll see why they were such sticklers for no outside food or drink. And this lady comes up with, and this was at Harkins and Fashion Square. It doesn't exist anymore, but in Arizona, in Scottsdale, there is this mall. It's kind of a richy mall. I mean, it has a lot of high-end stores. And of course, it's a place everyone wants to go in summer because it's air-conditioned. And Harkins Fashion Square, there were seven theaters. You know, we had seven screens, small theater in the mall. And I was there, and it was a nice place to work, but we were right in the middle of the food court. So like the food court was right around us. And so this one lady came up to me, and she had just this big takeaway, clear plastic box with like her salad or like a wrap in it. So she had like this entire thing, and she walked up and had her ticket. And I said, "Oh, ma'am, you can't take that in here." And she said, "Who's gonna stop me?" And then she just kept walking and went to her theater. And I thought to myself, not me. They only pay me $5 an hour. It's not Fort Knox or something like that. I don't care. So that was what I took from that. So I'll get back into kind of the secrets of how the movie theater operates. But let's start, when I'm talking about movie theaters themselves, let's go and dive into a little bit of history. So the very first motion picture, the very first motion pictures that took place kind of in the 19th century were called magic lantern shows. According to Wikipedia, magic lanterns used a glass lens, a shutter, and a powerful lamp to project images from glass slides onto a white wall or screen. These slides were originally hand-painted. So people would go and just kind of watch like, kind of like a picture show, but not like a rapid picture show. It was just more like, oh, it was just kind of like an art gallery, but instead of going from picture to picture, walking, they kind of go on the screen from picture to picture, and you would just watch that. The invention of the argon lamp in the 1790s, limelight in the 1820s, and the intensely bright electric arc lamp in the 1860s increased the brightness of the images. You recognize something there, that in the 1820s they had something called limelight. So you've probably heard something near the expression, "Oh, he loves being in the limelight." Well, that refers to how an oxyhydrogen flame, when an oxyhydrogen flame is directed at a cylinder of quicklime or calcium oxide, it gets really hot. It burns to like over 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit and becomes incredibly bright. There's a similar reaction, I believe, in a gas range on a stove. If you notice that, you know, the stove gets, the flames under the stove react and have a certain color to them. And I think there's a similar chemical reaction there. So that's what limelight was. You took quicklime and you would set it on fire with a flame, and it would get really, really, really bright and allow to project these images. Probably not the safest thing to do in a movie theater before you had better fire protection technology, but that's what they did. And so they would heat up calcium oxide or quicklime. And that is where the phrase the limelight comes from. And so now you know. But these weren't movies in the traditional sense. The first motion pictures says that simulations of movement date as far back as to 1828, when Paul Roget, or Roget, I don't know, Paul R-O-G-E-T, discovered the phenomenon he called persistence of vision. I think he was French. All this stuff started in France. The first movie theater is really in France. He showed that when a series of still images are shown rapidly in front of a viewer's eye, the images merge into one registered image that appears to show movement, an optical illusion, since the image is not actually moving. This experience was further demonstrated through Roget's introduction of the thaumatrope, a device which spun a disc with an image on its surface at a fairly high rate of speed. So the persistence of vision, seeing this, you see this in children's flip books. Like you buy a flip book for your kids and they flip through it and it's just got like, you know, I don't know, like 24 or 30 little cards. But if you flip them fast enough, it looks like the person is moving or the horse is running. And so cinema film is shown at 24 frames per second. And if you shoot film, if you shoot film at different frames per second, that's how you can create slow motion. Like if you shoot it at higher frames per second, like 48 frames per second, that's how. If you shoot it at like thousands of frames per second, then you can see like explosions in slow motion that normally would just happen in the blink of an eye. So that's essentially the principle. When you watch a film, film is shot on 24 frames per second. When I would do video, and I used to do video and I would compare it to film, we had to do the transitions. Most video cameras would shoot things, at least back when I was doing this. You can get cameras now that make things look more like film. But it would shoot, because you watch like a film, right? If you watch an older film, it feels different when you're seeing even a film from like the 70s, the 80s, and 90s versus like digital things today. You're like, why does it look different? It's because of the part of it is the frames per second. The other thing is, of course, is that film is using photographs, whereas video is using magnetic tape or pixels or electronic information. And so film, when it's shot at 24 frames per second, looks different than video, which was usually shot at like 29.97 frames per second, if I'm remembering accurately. So that, of course, is much later on. Before, it was just film that would start. And the first film was created by Louis and Auguste Lumière, the Lumière brothers. And that was the Sortie de l'Usine Lumière de Lyon. I think that's the one where it's the train entering the station. There's another one where it's just people leaving a factory. But the train leaving a station was like the first big thing. People in France went, they're like, oh man, this is crazy. I think it's an urban legend that people thought the train was coming at them and like was going to run them over. But it was still a big deal that people could see this. I think that was like in 1894, 1898. So we get film, starts off there with, just motion pictures in the late 1890s. Then the next big innovation with film happens in the 1920s, that prior to this, most films were silent films. You watched it and there was someone who was playing the organ alongside it. A few years ago, my wife and I, we had the privilege here in San Diego to go to Balboa Park. There is a large organ pavilion in Balboa Park. I think it's called like Speckles Organ Pavilion. And they were playing The Phantom of the Opera. And The Phantom of the Opera, the older version of it, is a silent film. And so the guy was doing the organ, playing it, while the film was going on. Another famous silent film of that era is Metropolis. I think that was Fritz Lang. And so you better believe I took advantage at Scottsdale Community College of taking the history of cinema course. It was a great class because we just did 13, 14 weeks. We would sit in a plush auditorium and just watch movies. And it was great, and I got college credit for it. and that shows you why some people are struggling in college. Like, why can't I get a job with my degree? I watched movies for 4 years. So Metropolis is a great film to watch because people come up with different soundtracks for it. It's a cool, like, really old dystopian science fiction film, Metropolis. And we just put on a soundtrack for a German thriller movie called Run, Lola, Run. But there's different soundtracks people put forward, to try to get the energy out there. But it was silent, and you had to make the music along with it. But in 1927, Warner Brothers released the first talkie, and that was a movie called The Jazz Singer. Now, most of The Jazz Singer is actually a silent film, and it uses those title cards. But the parts where Al Jolson is singing in it, where he's playing the piano when he's singing, that was recorded with a Vitaphone microphone, and it was played at the same time. And audiences loved it. So here, I'll play a clip of it here for you.
Blue skies from now on. You like that, Mama?
Yes.
I'm glad of it. I'd rather please you than anybody I know of. Oh, darling, will you give me something?
What?
You'll never get. Shut your eyes, Mama. Shut them for little Jackie. Oh, I'm going to steal something. I'll give it back to you someday too. You see,
he gave her a little kiss in that scene. I play this scene, not what audiences really loved in The Jazz Singer was not the music that they heard, but it was the fact that they got to hear Jolson. Like, this is a scene where he's playing the piano for his mother and he's kind of having a little banter with her and being cutesy. People loved that because you couldn't really have that before, because previously you would go to a silent film, there was a guy there who could play the piano. And I mean, if he was good enough, he could sing along with it, but he just usually played the piano. But what people love was that not only are they getting the music, but like they're hearing the actual words of the character in the film talking just like them, and they're entering into it. Whereas if you just saw him kind of talking to his mom like that, and you just had the words up there, you couldn't enter into it as deeply as actually hearing you reading the words is different than hearing like the tenderness in his voice and hearing him express himself, getting that element of the actor's performance into it. So it was revolutionary. And then the talkies started to dominate things there into the 1920s and the 1930s. Then so those were the films, but how did the theaters react? Usually when people went to the theater, it was a high class affair, that it was something you went to. It was like going to a stage play or a theater. So they wanted to keep it pretty classy. And usually you would go, and just like if you went to a theater, like when I lived in Phoenix, I would go to, you know, Herberger Theater sometimes, or you went to an actual dramatic theater. It's usually just one stage. It's one stage and it's a large auditorium. And movie theaters were thought of in the same way. It's a high class affair and you have one screen and people go and they watch. And there are a few theaters like that today. Usually they're art house theaters that have one screen. I used to live in Encinitas, California, actually. I lived just a few blocks away from La Paloma Theater. And I think they still have only one screen and they show art house films. And I think they also do the midnight performances of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which I will say to you, going to a midnight performance of Rocky Horror Picture Show is not for the faint of heart. So just a fair warning there for you. If you don't know what the Rocky Horror Picture Show is, maybe we'll cover it in future episode for musicals and things like that. But in 1957, Canada became the first country to have a two-screen theater. The Elgin Theater in Ottawa, Ontario became the first venue to offer two film programs on different screens in 1957. And so in the 50s and 60s, we had the rise of the multiplex and the megaplex, where if you had like more than 15 or 20 screens, you became like officially like a megaplex. Also in the 1950s, we saw the rise of the drive-in. So in the 1950s, there were 4,000 drive-in movie theaters across the country, 4,000 of them in the 1950s. Today, there's only 300, which I think is kind of sad. I've been to the drive-in only a handful of times in my life. But back in the 1950s, you know, post-World War II, there was a huge increase in automobile purchases. People wanted to go for long drives. They liked spending time in their cars. And it was just a fun way to go out, especially when movie theaters may not be able to accommodate as many people, or if they didn't have things like air conditioning. People enjoyed a summer night out going to see things at the drive-in and to enjoy, and teenagers would all pile into one car to go and watch the films. But eventually, as the 20th century progressed, the drive-in movie theater suffered a serious decline. This is an excerpt from an article from the LA Times in 1988. So in the 50s, there were 4,000 theaters. By the end of the 80s, there were only about 2,000 drive-ins. And this is what it says. There's an interview with David Baker, who owned a theater since 1957. He said, "I don't know why people aren't coming now like they did 2 years ago. Business is down. VCRs have hurt us more than anything else that has come down the pike." He said about one third of his grassy parking spaces were filled sometimes, a disappointing turnout for a Saturday night. He said the land became valuable. It became too valuable to devote to a seasonal operation. And so that's why a lot of drive-ins, if you go to them, there's still a few. There's one here in San Diego nearby us at Santee, which is a town just a little bit east of San Diego. And they do the drive-ins, but during the day, they make most of their money with car shows and flea markets and swap markets, because you just can't have this giant space not being used during the day. But especially when you go like back east, a lot of drive-ins, people just didn't go to them because it was bad weather. It could rain or it could snow. You don't want to go there. It's too cold. There are bugs. The bugs would get in front of the screens, and the guys have to go and try to get the bugs away from the projectors. And then eventually when movie theaters went to digital, that really killed a lot of the drive-ins, because the drive-ins would project these films and relied on that. And now movie theaters today are switching. Most of the major studios, major movie theaters, Regal, Edwards, most big movie theaters have gone to digital, and they don't have to use film. And here's the thing, I don't know if it's helpful for that, depending on how you think of it. Films deteriorate over time. It's a physical thing. So as a film is played over and over again, it has a short lifespan, it starts to fade, it starts to crack. And so movie theaters will only show films, physical films on a reel for a set amount of time. And then they would pawn them off to the discount theater. I loved going to Pollock Tempe Cinema's discount theater in Phoenix. They had $2 Tuesday. And so I would go there with friends. And was the quality of the film great? No. But I mean, I could watch. It was watchable. And it was only $2 to go see a movie. And so that's the cycle of the films. But now everything's going to digital. And if it's digital, it doesn't wear. And actually, what's crazy, if you heard in the news a few weeks ago, the movie Cats, which sounds horrible, by the way. If I used to be able to see free movies when I worked at Harkins. And so I could go every week and see two movies for free, just whenever I wanted. And I usually use that perk to go and see bad movies that I would normally not pay for. I remember once I went to a Harkins theater with my employee discount, and I got a free ticket to The Master of Disguise with Dana Carvey. So Dana Carvey is Garth from Wayne's World. He was on Saturday Night Live. He would do the impersonation of George Bush, 41, George Bush Sr. He did the church lady. Well, isn't that special? And he was in this movie, The Master of Disguise, which was terrible. It's a horrible, horrible movie. And I remember the woman at the ticket counter, I gave her my employee discount. She said, "Are you sure you really want to see this?" It was asking me like I'm about to like go into war or something. Like I'm about to step on the boat going to Normandy. "Are you sure you want to get in there and do that?" And I was like, "Well, it's free, so I might as well. And I still want my money back." So I would go and do that. Great. Now I've completely lost my train of thought here, and maybe it will come back to me. So those were so we were talking about digital film with movie theaters, and that's where the major chains have transferred over with there. So if there was something else I was going to, I'll try to bring it back. But let's move on to something else you may not know about with the rise of movie theaters, and that is catching pirates. So piracy in films is a big deal. I was reading an article actually a few years ago. Some guys were trying to make a pirated film of Fast and the Furious. Like they're trying to record it so they could bootleg it, sell it online. So, you know, you can go when you go abroad, like when I travel internationally, there's always someone who tries to sell me like a DVD on the street corner. Like, "You want the new Fast and Furious movie?" I'm like, that is either not the Fast and the Furious or it's filmed from some guy's cell phone in a movie theater. And so companies are trying to create technology to keep that from happening. There's one that's been developed since 2004 called Pirate Eye. And this is what the article says about it. It says it works by using a short light impulse scan of a cinema three times during a film to detect any recording devices, even pinhole camcorders and video mobile phones. The impulse lasts a mere 20 milliseconds, whereas the brain will only pick up on light that lasts 40 milliseconds, responding to it after 200 milliseconds, meaning the audience won't see the scan occur. It also says it's capable of adding watermarking to the audio stream of a film. If someone manages to record a film, the watermarking is picked up in the recording, but not in your ears. And so it's able to distort the audio from pirates. So yeah, piracy is a big deal. But normally, I think a lot of movie theaters are not going to use the hidden cameras like that. They just send somebody in every like 10 minutes or so, every like three times during the movie, 20 or 30 minutes to see if people are secretly recording the film or if they're making out. And I worked at movie theaters and a lot of people would make out in there. So a lot of teenagers and older people. And it's really gross. I mean, teenagers, I get they're going to do that. But like when you're like in your 40s, I'm like, what are you doing here? Why are you at home? Why are you helping your kids, your grandkids even? Like, what is going on here? And so I remember once I saw friends of mine from our youth group. They were good. They were not making out, but they were on a date and I could tell they were nervous. And then I went in there and I had the flashlight. And I held the flashlight up to my face like a cop so he couldn't see it was me. And I was like, "Excuse me, what are you doing in here? Are you disrupting movie theaters? Can I see your tickets, please?" And then I moved the light away and they were super mad about that. Oh, those were the days. Another thing you may not know, so about keeping tabs on things in the movie theater, if you're in a movie theater and there's something wrong with a projector, you can't just yell at the back of the room to the projector room and say, "Hey, fix it," or start booing. There's probably nobody back there by the projector. There probably is nobody in the projector room. Projector room, digital. That's what I was going to talk about. I remember now. So movies are digital, right? So if you remember the film Cats that came out just recently and it's terrible, it was so bad, the movie studio sent a patch like, "Hey, we know there were bugs in this, like the first film, the fur was really bad and it was not CGI, right? So here's a better version." But what they sent was still awful. If you want to have nightmares, watch the trailer to the film Cats. Like Cats had its place in Broadway. That made sense. It's not the kind of thing you should put on film. I'm sorry, not even Jason Derulo can save Cats. And Jason Derulo can do lots of Jason Derulo things. So I will move on. There's no one in the projector room, and or there may be one guy in there, but usually those projectors start and stop automatically. And this has led to some mishaps. In 2016, a California theater showed the trailer for the very raunchy Seth Rogen animated comedy sausage party to an audience of children waiting to see Pixar's Finding Dory. For his part, Rogan was greatly amused by the error. The manager chalked the mistake up to the cartoon sequel being abruptly moved to a larger auditorium to accommodate the crowds, resulting in the wrong trailer being started. So that does happen. And movie theaters are understaffed. They're totally understaffed. You don't have people in the projection room. Even if you do concessions and you're there, you don't do concessions all the time. When there's a lull and people are in the theaters, the concession people get sent out to clean the movie theaters in shifts. And sometimes I would just be sent in there. I remember once I was sent into a 400-seat auditorium by myself to clean it. And yes, you better believe I just shoved the stuff under the seats. I would move them. I would shove them. It was a staircase auditorium. So if I couldn't pick up a bunch of the stuff and get it, because I was just like, you had to just get it clean, 400 seats by myself, I would shove it so that it was behind the seat, not under the seat, but it would end up being, I'd shove it to like the right and down. So it was behind the next row underneath. And then the night crew would have to deal with that. And I blame that on my managers. They gave me an impossible task and put me in an impossible situation. So if you have to throw away your stuff, please just throw it away. But if you leave it behind, and I leave it behind, I'm bad. I do that. Put it in the seat. Put it in the seat. It's easier to pick up and put in our trash cans than to bend over and have to pick it up. But theaters are, they are completely disgusting, as you would expect. They're disgusting from snacks. So let's round out everything here by talking about the snackies. That's, you're always tempted, right, when you go to theaters. Well, here's the thing. The ticket sales, they, I think like 70 or 80% of the ticket profit goes back to the movie studios. The movie theaters could not survive on ticket sales alone. It would be impossible. They couldn't do it. They make something like 25% of their income from concession sales, but that only represents 4% of their cost. So here's the thing, like 25% of the revenue comes from the concessions, but only 4% has to be spent on making the stuff. So it's like 20% pure profit there. Without concessions, movie theaters would fail. And so that's why there's such a markup. The markups are absolutely incredible. Here is a video from Business Insider where they talk about how the different items are marked up.
Then I compared this data to the best information I could find on the theater's wholesale costs. It's no secret that concession markups are huge, but some are worse than others. The markup on a small soda is 11 times the cost to the theater. That's a markup of 1,000%. The medium and large are slightly better, but still outrageous. However, if you have a bladder of steel and opt for the free refill on the large, the markup is only 4 times cost. I always pay 50 cents more for the slushie. Slushies don't really cost the theater more than sodas, so the markup is higher. The price of a small slushie is 13 times the theater cost, and the medium and large are marked up over 10 times. But popcorn is the worst. The markup on a small popcorn is about 19 times cost, according to the data we put together. And just like the drinks, as you size up, the markup goes down. But
so when you look at it, and the price table here is actually being conservative, the average cost to make a soda or a slushie or a popcorn is between 30 and 50 cents, and then it's sold for like $5 or $6. But I've been to theaters where it's like $8 or $9 for popcorn. So the markup is anywhere from 1,000% to like 2,000 or 2,500%. But it gets cut down. Instead of 1,000% markup, it's 500% if a guest takes advantage of the refill, for example. You get the free refill and do that. So that it's amazing how much they can make on that. But what you may not know is that there weren't always snacks in movie theaters. Why are there snacks in movie theaters? Remember what I said earlier? Going to the theater was like going to a stage theater, and you don't eat popcorn in like a refined, dramatic, at the Globe Theater or something like that, where Shakespeare is being performed for you. So what happened? Well, when the talkies came out, like the jazz singer in 1927, people more wanted to go to the movies, because before that it was an affair, you know, it was a high end affair. You went and you read subtitles, you read title cards, so you had to be literate to be able to do that. Even if you are literate, it's a lot of work. I mean, think about it. How often do you watch subtitled films? Probably not a lot. Maybe you want to feel smart, cultured. And I mean, not like that. There's great films out there you can enjoy that are subtitled. I honestly haven't watched a subtitled film in a while because it takes extra work to watch a foreign language film that is presented in subtitles. I mean, it's great. Probably the last one I saw was, I don't know, The Passion, maybe. I think before that, it was like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. But then when the talkies came along, average people wanted to go to the theaters more. And so what happened was outside of the movie theaters, vendors would sell popcorn and nuts and candy, and the vendors had carts outside of the movie theater, and you would buy from the vendor, and also people walking along on the street would buy popcorn too, and you would take it inside the movie theater. Then the movie theaters said, never mind, we're making this money, and they put up a little sign, no outside food and drink, you got to buy the popcorn in the theater. However, early on, popcorn was not the major seller. Usually theaters, what they would offer would be candy. You would buy candy and then go in to see and listen to the movie. But why the switch from candy to popcorn? The answer is in World War II. During World War II, there was a sugar shortage. Supplies of sugar, everything was being rationed. You know, tires, you know, rubber was rationed, steel was rationed. So people were always collecting scraps and doing their part for the war effort. And sugar was rationed as a commodity and supply to send to troops overseas. So there were sugar was extremely expensive. So the movie theaters, instead of selling candy that got expensive, they sold popcorn, which was a lot cheaper. And the popcorn stuck with the movie theaters all, you know, from till today. And since I speak about all of that food, I will end by telling you the little bit of the story, a little bit behind that favorite song. Hopefully you hear this is one of my favorite songs. When they bring it up in the movie theater, I'm like, yes, that is better than any of the dopey commercials they are showing today. And that, of course, would be Let's All Go to the Lobby. I shall play it for you.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
This song was actually created by the short film, and it's got like the little candy and the popcorn kind of walking and dancing along. It was created in 1957 by Dave Fleischer. Fleischer is a name, hopefully it rings a bell to you if you're a comic book fan or superhero fan. Dave Fleischer is the brother of Max Fleischer, and Max Fleischer used to do these wonderful old Superman cartoons from like the 1940s and 1950s where Superman just looks like he's a bunch of angles and his eyes are just like two closed lines. I love that old style of animation. The Fleischer cartoon animation, which was also, I think the Fleischer cartoons were big inspirations for Japanese anime overseas. And so Dave Fleischer, his brother, kept a similar style, made the Let's All Go to the Lobby vignette, or Snipe, it was called, as a little kind of mini commercial. And the tune, no one knows exactly where the tune comes from. We know that it predates, I think it's even before the 1700s. It was used in a piece by Beethoven called Wellington's Victory in 1813. But it's the same tune as We Won't Be Home Until Morning, the Bear Went Over the Mountain, and For He's a Jolly Good Fellow. For he's a jolly good fellow, the bear went over the mountain, let's all go to the lobby. And then there's another one here, Malbrousse va ten guerre. I probably butchered the French there. So that's where the tune came from, is what they put to the lyrics, has been around for a long time. It was used to finish out the rest of it.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy, the chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
And so hopefully I have not, now as you're listening to this podcast, you're thinking to yourself, let's all go to 7-Eleven or walk over to the fridge and eat something. So hopefully I haven't given you cravings you did not ask for. Hey, it was a lot of fun sitting down with you on this Friday. I really enjoy sharing Free For All Fridays with you. And of course, other episodes, a lot of great content is going to be coming up here in the next few weeks. I got episodes planned on proving the existence of God from the existence of stuff. I'll be doing a pro-life boot camp for everybody when we get to around the anniversary of Roe versus Wade. Do pray for me. I'll be traveling soon in a few weeks, going to the pro-life summit, live action. Students Life of America will be there. A lot of great things are happening here and at Catholic Answers. And once again, I'm grateful for all your support. Be sure to go to trenthornpodcast.com to support what we're doing. And I hope that you all have a very blessed day and a very blessed weekend. Take care, everybody.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.